Hey there, adventurer. I appreciate you taking the time to do an investigation check and dig into the archives of the show. I wanted to let you know that this is an old episode back when the show was called The Hard Thing Podcast. The topics are still the same, though the format and some of the names are different. If instead you are coming back to The Hard Thing Podcast, well, surprise, we changed our name and some of our branding. Feel free to hang out in the archives and listen to all the wonderful old episodes of The Hard Thing Podcast, or take on a new adventure by listening to some of our current episodes. Either way, happy adventuring.
How do you prepare for what you know will be probably a traumatic event or something that will stretch you to your extreme limits? That is a question we talk about today on The Hard Thing Podcast. Welcome back to another episode. I'm your host, Justin Lewis, and this is the show designed to help you improve your life by learning how to deal with the hard things in your life and prepare for the hard things later in life. I'm excited to give you my conversation with today's guest, Steve Giblin. He is a former Navy SEAL and also the author of Walking in Mud, which is a new book coming out. It is about 10 rules for dealing with difficulty and building resilience in your life. Today was an awesome conversation. We talk, here's a heads-up warning. It's a little bit more political leaning than most of our episodes. Just know that. And hopefully you continue and listen to the full episode, because I feel we do talk about things in a very tasteful way. It was a great conversation with Steve, and I learned a couple things, but more than anything, I hope you learn a couple things and take those things and then change your life. So without further ado, let's jump into my episode with Steven Giblin. All right. Well, thank you for coming on the Hard Thing Podcast, Steve. I'm excited to have you here and have this conversation with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Justin.
Yeah. Well, let's dive in asking the question that I ask every single guest. Steve, what's the hardest thing you've ever done?
So obviously I'm a retired SEAL. Every one of us has gone through Hell Week. Up until that point in my life, I would have to say that was the hardest thing I'd ever done. And still looking back on it now, you know, when other people ask, you know, what was it like? How was it? I've got a really good friend of mine right now that's a civilian. He's never done law enforcement. He's never done military. And he just honestly just couldn't believe, what we did during Hell Week. I guess I would have to say that was probably the hardest thing I'd ever done. 5.5 days of just nonstop movement. You get towards the end on Wednesday evening and sometime Thursday afternoon, you get 2 hours of sleep each day. But by then, I mean, science has proven that by, after 72 hours of no sleep, you're a bag of trash. And so they push you past that limit. In the continuous movement, the continuous exercises and going from one evolution to another, it's amazing what you're actually able to accomplish. But I will not lie to anybody. I felt like a Mack truck hit me at the end of that.
So a question that I've never asked, I think I've had at least one Navy SEAL, previous Navy SEAL on the show before, but I don't think I had the chance to ask him this question. Were there any experiences after Hell Week when you are officially a Navy SEAL, you've earned your Trident, and you're kind of set to work? You go to your stations or not stations, your assignments.
Yeah.
In the service after you are officially a Navy SEAL, were there any experiences that maybe rivaled Hell Week in difficulty, or was Hell Week really kind of that much harder, so that way everything else kind of was easier?
And that's a great question, because that is sort of, the methodology behind Hell Week is to prepare you for anything that gets thrown at you. My first tour in the teams, I was assigned to the old UDT 22, which during the summer that I got into the teams, we actually the teams went through a massive reorganization, and UDTs were either converted to a SEAL team or to an SDV team. And SDVs are the mini subs, wet submersibles. And you dive them, you're breathing from scuba. And so that was my first 4 years. And we did a lot of we did cold water dives, warm water dives. You know, we trained in the Caribbean, we dove off the waters of Denmark and the UK, the East Coast teams. You don't necessarily have to travel to dive in the warm waters or the cold waters. You just wait for the seasons to change. And, Little Creek and Little Creek, Chesapeake Bay in the wintertime, that is some really damn cold water. I would say, honestly, one of the bigger challenges was doing the longer dives, the longer dive profiles in cold water and even in warm water. My longest dive in warm water was 10 and a half hours. So, people had already gone to work, worked their full work day, had gone home and were probably eating dinner by the time that we were wrapping up that one dive. And, we hadn't had anything to drink, nothing to eat because we were on scuba the entire time. And, we were dehydrated, we were famished beyond all belief. And that's just to me an example of, kind of another day in the teams, but pushing ourselves beyond what's normal.
I think that it kind of sticks out to me as a theme of your experiences, maybe, is that in the teams and probably in as many military outfits as can do it, they try and put their personnel in extreme situations to hopefully prepare them for unpreparable extreme situations. So in going up to Hell Week, what sort of things had you done to try and prepare yourself to make yourself have as good of a shot as possible?
Actually, nothing. I did nothing before I went to BUDS. I worked out hard. I worked out every day. I wouldn't just, go for a run and then call it a day. I'd go for a run and then lift weights and do calisthenics, push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, those kind of things, always trying to improve my numbers. The next day I would go to the pool and swim, and I would maybe, run to the pool, a couple of miles to the base pool, and then swim and then run back, and, things like that. But, in training in BUDS, once you finally get to BUDS, it's, they prepare you for Hell Week. They prepare you quite well. The first several weeks of a first phase, it's constant movement. You do probably four very strenuous physical evolutions every day. And, in between those evolutions, you're running, trotting, what we call the BUD shuffle, as a class, moving like a herd of antelope, going across the base, from point A to point B, or you're in classroom, or, you're learning how to do some of the other evolutions. And all the while, that is all preparation leading up to Hell Week. And then during Hell Week, you're basically just repeating all these physical evolutions continuously. They build you up on the distance that you swim in the ocean. They build you up on, the drown proofing techniques. So everything that you don't have to learn anything prior to going to BUDS. Yes, you have to be physically active. Yes, you have to know how to swim. You have to know how to run. You got to be able to do, a certain amount of push-ups in 2 minutes, sit-ups, 2 minutes, X number of pull-ups, so on and so forth, right? But they pretty much train you, and what they're training you for, it's the life cycle of BUDS is stress inoculation. Stress inoculation prepares you for combat. So the Marine Corps with their boot camp in the Crucible, and then their basic infantry course, the Army, same thing. Then you get into the other special operations units, Air Force, PJs, and CCT, Special Forces, Rangers, all those guys. They all have similar courses, and what they're really going for is stress inoculation. Getting you prepared and ramping you up to when the shit hits the fan, you're able to handle it and you're able to still continue the mission.
I think that is, honestly, that's kind of one of the central tenets of the Hard Thing podcast, is figuring out how do all these people who've done such amazing and really cool things do them, and how can other people who don't learn to do them? And, stress inoculation, or that concept, has come up quite a lot. And I think that's actually probably a pretty good segue into your book, because from my understand, that's exactly what your book is about, specifically with regards to society and kind of how we're bouncing back from COVID, right?
Yeah, bouncing back from COVID, kind of what's that, what can be the methodology? Some people don't know how to bounce back. Some people aren't sure what, what resilience really is. And, it's not really a how-to book. It's just more of a stop and think book. Mm-hmm. And anybody that's watched the news or read the news or anything like that, I mean, some of the outlandish things that have been going on during COVID, really, I mean, that was just, it made me stop and think. And I was a prolific writer and journaler, probably the last 15 years or so. And, and I saved a lot of things. I did electronically and also kept handwritten journals. And so I saved a lot of things that just made me, kind of reflect and, take pause and kind of really assess what it was that I was doing, how I was acting in life, and how other people were acting in life. When I got out of the teams, when I retired in 2009, I got a job in the civilian sector, civil service. And I was dealing with a myriad of different types of personalities, people that had never been in the military, but were now, they were working for the military. Other people that, had been in the military and were, now civil service, and, but they didn't do exactly what I had done. Right. So you're dealing with this melting pot of personalities. And I became keenly aware that I couldn't treat everybody the way that I would treat my teammates, right? I couldn't speak to them, in certain ways and use certain colorful language that would, not necessarily inspire people, but would just get them moving and get them in the right direction. So that's kind of, that was my awakening as to, how people really treat each other, outside of the military.
That's really interesting. I've not served in the military. I have had multiple conversations on this show and, handful of friends that have served in the military. And I've never really thought about it that way, that perhaps I might need to do kind of the same thing and really understand where whoever I'm talking to is coming from, to understand how best to interact with them on a personal and maybe professional level. And I think that is probably a really good tip for leadership, in that you really need to understand, or as best you can, the people you lead or the people around you in order to lead them the best, right?
Yeah. Without a doubt, there's there's arguments and then there's discussions. And I hated arguments, because typically what happens in an argument, and it doesn't matter who it's with, colleague, coworker, spouse, what have you. An argument, you're not necessarily listening to what the other person is saying. You are basically reacting and thinking about what you're going to say next to win the argument. Whereas in a discussion, you're actually open-minded, you're listening, active listening, and you're being courteous to, one another, and you're having an exchange of ideas. And I always tried to go into any kind of of a discussion, you know, any kind of a meeting as a discussion and an open exchange of ideas. I think, you know, too, now what you're seeing, you know, even politically, as politically divided as the country is, I think that's we're in just a big argument. And a big argument as to who's right, who's wrong, whether it's, you know, the Republicans or the Democrats. And it doesn't really matter. We've just got this great divide between us and we're talking past each other. And that's what an argument is. We're not necessarily discussing things. So, you know, and I think, you know, and it boils all the way down to just, you know, just the everyday citizen who doesn't have a, you know, a dog in the fight politically. But, you know, how are we behaving towards one another?
I really like how you put that. We're just all in a big argument. And, you know, as I've kind of paid more attention to the news, I mean, I'm 27. I'm not old by any stretch of the imagination. But obviously, you know, when you're 18, you don't really pay much attention to the news generally. So as I've kind of paid more attention, I've noticed that, like you said, we're in this big argument and the things we're arguing about keep changing so much that I think that's proof positive that we're just arguing for arguing's sake, just to be right, because there's always something else new to argue about that we could maybe be right about, you know?
Always. You know, my wife and I were talking about it at dinner tonight. We've got a really good friend of ours. She's a dental hygienist. And there seems to be this overwhelming shortage of dental hygienists in New York, and it might be even nationwide. And, you know, but in New York State, you know, specifically, the state has mandated that healthcare workers will get the vaccine. And so, you know, they've had multiple interviews on the news, you know, covering down on these people. And I mean, quite honestly, I do feel for them. And, but they're not getting the vaccine based on personal principles, you know, and then they're crying to the, you know, they're obviously they're upset and they're literally crying during the interview that they don't know what they're going to do for their next job. You know, this is their livelihood and things like that. And if they could just take a step back and listen to what it is they're actually saying and whether or not, you know, the vaxxers and the non-vaxxers, it doesn't really matter. You know, I've had both of my, you know, I've had both shots and I feel fine. The government's not tracking me. I don't have some sort of, you know, chip in place to me or whatever. But it's really bewildering to me that people are willing to sacrifice their livelihood, their income, and to be able to support their family or to help support their family based off of what they perceive as government overreach. And I mean, I get it. And there's, you know, I truly do understand it. I've listened to, you know, discussions, friends of mine and I have had this discussion on, you know, what is government overreach and, you know, should the government be telling everybody to get the vaccine? I agree in the sense, you know, with the president that it is national security. You know, if we continue to lose the number of lives that we're losing and, you know, then we've got the long haulers, the people that are now perpetually sick and having things going on because of COVID and their reluctance to get the vaccine, you know, was it really worth it? And, you know, this again, you know, so that's this argument. And I think it needs to turn into more of a discussion and people to really, you know, they say there's no science behind it. They've put a lot of science behind it. They rushed, you know, they had to. It's kind of like, you know, when we packed up and went to Afghanistan, you know, I mean, we didn't really have time to throw together battle plans to go to Afghanistan, you know, not the in-depth ones, like when we're really, no kidding, we're going to go invade a country or what have you, you know. You know, that was a very, you know, reactionary combat, you know, we'll figure it out when we get there kind of thing.
Right.
This is, you know, we're still figuring it out and, you know, luck was on our side. And I think this vaccine is really saving a lot of lives. I just wish that, you know, people could honestly look past that. And if it means the difference between you having a job and not having a job, good God, get the vaccine. You know, save your livelihood.
Yeah. I hate to say it because I can see both sides of someone in that predicament. And I can really sympathize at how tough a decision that can be. And I myself did not get vaccinated, but recently just had COVID. And the conflict. And I think the biggest issue with it is that maybe not inherently, but somehow organizations or groups of people or parties have maneuvered themselves into a position in that in some way, shape, or form, they gain by people vaccinating or non-vaccinating politically. And yeah. I think that's the problem. If, I was about 8 or 9 when 9/11 happened, and that was a massive, you know, it shattered kind of the innocence of America, I think.
Yeah.
And I remember, and I still remember now, kind of this outpouring of a desire to unify and to come together and say, hey, you know, we're America, we are one. And I just don't understand why that hasn't happened. And I think maybe it did happen for the first few months, but as the COVID pandemic wore on, I think people kind of forgot the urgency of unification.
Well, it became political, you know, and again, you know, I try to remain, out of the political. I really despise politics. And, so I don't side with one or the other.
Yeah.
But, the previous president, I mean, he kicked the can down the road. He called it a hoax. He denied the science of this, I think he referred to it initially as, it's just like the flu. And, but people were dying. And of a terrible, terrible way to die. I've got a really good friend of mine that survived it. He had it bad. He and his sister both got it. She died while he was in a coma. And, she died of COVID. And he survived it. He was going through rehab for almost a year. And he still has issues. He's a long hauler. And this is a fellow teammate of mine that, I mean, this guy was, super stud, I mean, this guy did, he did the Echo Challenge. He did the Raid Galois. Among other things, he loved doing extreme sports and things like that. And, it brought him down to his knees, almost dying. And, luckily he had top-notch medical care. I think that's a big difference between, for some people, surviving and not surviving, for those that have to go to the hospital. Once you're admitted into the hospital, that's a whole nother game. A lot of people, the overwhelming majority of people that have gotten COVID, were lucky enough that they got to stay home. They didn't have to go to the hospital and, go into the ICU or anything like that. I don't know how, I'm assuming that that's what yours was. You were at home, but you were just felt like hell, right?
For me, I don't drink, and I've never taken any drugs. I hate things that change my mental state or my emotional control. I don't like laughing gas. It makes me fall asleep. COVID impacted me on an emotional level. Even still, I'm still kind of dealing with some leftover emotional issues from COVID. It impacted me on an emotional level more than most other things in my life. Honestly, I hate to say it, but because there are so many people out there who's done way, way harder things, but I think it might have been, or at least dealing with it then and still somewhat currently, it might have become one of the hardest things I've ever had to do just because it's so new to me. And I think that's one reason why COVID might be having so many so many far-reaching effects is because of its novelty and what we don't know about it. Earlier, you talked about resilience and how most people don't really understand what resilience is, even if they can define it. What sort of, I guess, on a, you know, for personal, for people, right? What sort of recommendations would you give to someone to build up resiliency? And even in the face of COVID, you know, with the threat of COVID, what can someone do to hopefully bolster their resilience so that way going in, they're somewhat prepared, coming out, they have the tools they need to kind of get back to life as normal?
Well, you know, life as normal has ceased to exist as we knew it, you know. You know, we're in this new normal that is, our society has changed, our politics have changed, our governments and even the way of doing work has changed. Resilience is nothing more than being able to bounce back from something traumatic. And it can be, you know, for me, it was Buds and Hell Week, as with a lot of my other teammates. For some, it's combat. For some, it's, you know, I would say for the vast majority of the world, it's COVID. You know, and back at the, you know, back in 1918, we had the Spanish flu. And I mean, you know, you want to talk about unprepared and not having the scientific technologies that we have today, you know, but we bounced back from it and we learned some things. I think we forgot a lot of things too from it as well. That was one of the first things that I looked up when COVID came along, was when was the last pandemic? And it was 1918 and it was the Spanish flu. And, you know, it just really wreaked havoc. So resiliency is going into it. Number one, you're going into it with going into something with, you know, your head down and you're, you know, in a, you know, try to be in the strongest posture that you could be in and being prepared for setbacks. And when you're prepared for setbacks, when they come, they're not a surprise. When failures come, they're not a surprise. And it's almost, you know, along the same lines as visualization and, you know, anticipating what can go wrong, going through all the, you know, all the what ifs of, you know, what could happen. You know, what I was talking about earlier about, you know, the people, you know, giving up their livelihood because they don't want to get vaccinated. I think a lot of those people, that was a very emotional decision. And it wasn't a well thought out decision. They didn't go through those what ifs and realizing that, you know, crap, you know, I've just given up a career, something I went to college for to, you know, and now based off principle, I decided not to go through with it. Now I've lost my job. And, you know, I've got, you know, a family, kids, a house, bills, things like that. Those second, third order effects that a lot of people don't think about. Resilience is being able to think ahead of all of those and coming out the other side with a clear and distinct path. And, you know, like I said, you know, earlier, I've got nothing against anybody that has not been vaccinated. That's totally, it's a personal decision. And I definitely see where you're coming from. Me as a military guy, I've had more vaccines and inoculations than I can count on both hands and both feet. You know, I got the anthrax vaccine for 10 years straight, and talk about something that we knew nothing about, right? Was this anthrax vaccine, but we were told you got to get it. And if you don't want to get it, then it's time to move on, you know, and I was at the tier one level at that time. And, you know, you could easily be, you know, disinvited to the game, if you will. You know, and that was actually the ultimatum that everybody on the, you know, everybody at our command was given. Yeah, well, what if we don't want to get it? Well, then you can just leave. You know, you can go back to Little Creek or go back to Coronado and continue life as a, you know, unvaccinated teen guy, you know, no anthrax. Ultimately, a lot of, you know, just about everybody ended up getting the anthrax vaccine, all the way down to the general purpose forces. We were the first ones to get it because we were supposed to be the first, you know, frontline, you know, people going in for special operations. So for me, getting the vaccine, you know, the COVID vaccine, it was nothing. It really was nothing. I had no second thoughts about it. Anytime I went overseas, I had to get vaccinated for something. So for me, it was absolutely no second thoughts on that. Other people, I could definitely see that. You know, and it's, that's when they've really got to, you know, kind of have that, you know, and I know you went through it, you know, that moral discussion with yourself or your spouse, and, you know, a lot of, you know, hand wringing about it. You know, and people, you know, they do need to think about, you know, that's, you know, what's going to happen, you know, what's going to happen on the other end of it. And, you know, for those that are, that might be predisposed due to other medical conditions, you know, geez, you're really, you know, you're playing Russian roulette. You know, the diabetics, the, you know, those type of people, you know, I just, it's, to me, it's, you gotta go into that headlong. My stepdaughter, her boyfriend actually went through cancer treatment during the peak of COVID, and he couldn't get the vaccine. And he was deathly afraid of, you know, he's got the already weakened immune system because of chemo and everything else. And, you know, I mean, that's a whole nother worry to, you know, to put on, you know, to have weighing on you. So, you know, this is kind of the state that the country and the world is in, is, you know, get vaccinated or not. And how do we come out the other end? How do we come out the other end stronger, you know, from all this? And it comes from having these setbacks. And unfortunately, some of the setbacks might be a little bit harder than anybody planned on, you know, losing a family member, maybe, you know, things like that. So, yeah. You know, that's a tough one.
I'm a religious guy. Are you religious, Steve?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I believe in God. I'll tell you that, but yeah. I don't attend church, and I don't, you know, those things. No.
Right. Hopefully this analogy kind of comes across for those who aren't particularly religious and or faith-based. I hope that's how you say it. You know, in my faith or religion, it's very common to think, you know, God, your will be done, and kind of ask for blessings, but understand that he has his own plan. And there's the faith that his plan is often better than mine. And that's totally fun and easy to believe in when you're doing fine, nothing wrong is happening, because you're like, wow, this plan is really great. And then, yeah. You know, and even for those who don't particularly ascribe to the belief in God, having a faith that things can get better, that faith gets really tried when you are faced with the death of a loved one, or unexpected illness, or dealing with mental or emotional problems that you have no control over of. And I think going through those things can almost be more debilitating than, you know, losing a job sometimes, based on each person. So I would highly encourage each and every person to, when you're thinking about building up your resiliency, don't think just physically or mentally, think emotionally and perhaps even spiritually,
or spiritually, right. You know, your
connection to the world at large. Because one thing that I personally noticed from COVID is everyone's been separated, right? You know, we work at home, and then getting COVID, you can't see anyone. And then I find myself with some emotional issues after COVID, and seeing people is probably one of the best things that's helped me. And it's really hard. So Again, don't just prepare yourself for resilience physically, but also work on, you know, social resilience, mental, emotional, spiritual. Another question I wanted to ask you, unless you wanted to add something to that.
No. Yeah, I'm good. Let's move.
You were talking about one part of resilience is, you know, thinking ahead through all the scenarios. And I can easily see someone like myself. Well, I can't see someone like myself doing Hell Week per se, just because I think I'd need a lot more preparation. But, you know, if I were in a situation like that, I could easily see myself maybe overthinking the future and starting to get some anxiety and kind of spiraling down that. So what sort of things did you do to keep yourself level-headed during Buds and Hell Week and even during the rest of your career when, you know, you had to control yourself emotionally, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It does make sense. I was taught from a very young age, my father, he used to tell us all the time not to overthink things. You know, we didn't have the best childhood growing up. My folks were divorced. My mother was an alcoholic, so was my stepfather. And my father was on the other end of the spectrum. He hardly drank at all. He was a policeman, solid work background, solid work ethic. And we ended up going to live with him because the chaos at, you know, living with my mother was just that. It was chaos. And it was chaos. It was violence. It was alcohol. Exposure to all these things for, you know, a seven-year-old is really not that good. So when my father, you know, brought us, you know, he got custody of us and our life started to change. One of the biggest things he always said to us was to not overthink things. And he kind of put us through his own training regimen, if you will. You know, one day he comes home with a stopwatch and he's like, "Hey, look what I got. I got this brand new stopwatch. And guess what you're going to go do? And, you know, I'm going to time you in a 1 mile run, you know, first 7 minute mile I ever ran in my life." And I was, I was 9 years old, but, the things that he taught us were things that you couldn't learn in school. And that was the grit. That was resiliency. That was, you know, being able to not overthink things and work through the adversity, that whatever it is that you might be facing, you know, having a bad day. Okay. Just think on it, reflect on it, and then move on. Don't dwell on it. And, you know, dwelling on, you know, a lot of the small things, they end up piling up and turning into a big thing over what, you know, what's really the, you know, why is it really become a big thing? So my going through Buds and going through, you know, the first part of first phase, leading up to Hell Week, it was, you know, you finished each day. You felt like, you know, just hammered dog crap. And, you know, but then you thought back on it and, you know, maybe even discussed it with classmates of, you know, or your boat crew, what could we have done better as a boat crew? And, you know, what could we, you know, or your swim buddy, maybe you didn't do as well on your 2 mile ocean swim as you would have liked to have done. So you get with your swim buddy and you're like, "Hey, what could we have done better?" So you kind of build this into your life cycle of, you know, your daily routines. What could I have done better? How can I overcome the obstacles that I face today when I face them again tomorrow? You know, things like that. We have people that get extremely spun up on traffic, somebody coming into work and they're just angry as hell because, you know, somebody cut them off in traffic or something. And it's, you know, they take it personally. You know what? Get past it, move on. Don't take it as a personal attack. You know, it's just somebody, you know, somebody with their head up their ass and, you know, they cut you off, you know, that kind of thing. They were distracted, probably, you know, probably got their phone in their hand, mm-hmm. You know, so that's one of those things. And, you know, and I catch myself getting irritated in traffic when people aren't paying attention. You know, nobody can drive as good as me, by the way. So I'm one of the world's best drivers. So I think we all think that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's, you know, getting past the events of today, you know, and facing tomorrow. And I always try to, every day I wake up, number one, I wake up with gratitude that I'm in the position that I'm in. And that is I'm above ground. I'm happy in my relationship with my wife. I live in what I consider to be a great place. You know, even though, you know, we get, you know, several feet of snow a year, I don't care. I love it actually. And, you know, so, I mean, and that's how I start my day. And I try to be a better version of myself every day. And, you know, and I take everything, you know, with a grain of salt of, you know, what I read, what I hear, what I listen to. And if I'm really concerned about something, you know, what's going on in the country or something like that, I always try to validate it. I don't go off of, you know, first reports. I think a lot of people tend to do that and they get spun up off of something that they saw or read on social media that's completely wrong. You know, it was, you know, invented or contrived, and now it's being spread as, you know, as truth. You know, so we have a lot of that going on.
Yeah. I love your talk about traffic. My wife has some pretty bad road rage, to be honest, and she's actually a delivery driver. So that's not necessarily the right job choice. But I talked to her on the phone today while she was at work, and she was driving, and she said someone cut her off. And then she remarked, like, I don't have any road rage today, and I have no idea why. And I was, you know, you talking about that just brought that up to me. And it kind of made me think, you know, how many people have I cut off in traffic that I'm never going to meet, and they're just going to be mad at me, and I'm never going to know, you know? So kind of some food for thought there. But kind of going back to your dad. See, I thought that was an interesting story, because parents really do teach us what schools can't, those things that may not be able to be explained. Right. And you know, we try and explain it on this podcast, but I'm sure that for all of our talk of resiliency, there's no way we can really tell someone, hey, this is how you be resilient. Hopefully we can just give them some guidance and they can somewhat find it themselves. But I think with what your father did, you know, kind of that aspect of moving on and not overthinking, that's something you can tell people, but more so you learn from example. And I right. think that's probably how he taught you, basically saying this is how you move on. But then he himself did that same thing. So I thought that was a really interesting thing to bring up.
100%. Intrusive parenting, there is no replacement for it. And like you said, the schools can't do what parents do. And that's where, you know, people will say, you know, well, my kids spend 8 hours a day at the school or 10 hours a day at the school, and the teachers are responsible for how my child thinks and acts. And nothing can be further from the truth, because the day begins with being at home and either one or both parents being there, hopefully. And, you know, and starting that day right. You know, when my siblings and I were still living with my mom after my folks got divorced, you know, she was a cocktail waitress, and, you know, she wasn't getting home until 2 or 3 in the morning, and she was not up in the morning with us when we went to school. We typically had a bad start to every day, and it was, you know, and that led to problems in school. When we went to go live with my father is a policeman. At that point in time, he was senior enough to where he could choose, you know, what shift he was going to work. And so he made sure that he was there in the morning when we left for school, and, you know, sort of that, you know, that pep talk every morning, you know, have a great day. You know, you had a great breakfast and, you know, let's make sure you're squared away. You know, is your hair combed, your teeth are brushed, you know, tuck in your shirt and, you know, off to school you go. And, you know, just some of those simple things in life that, you know, getting that good start off every day. I personally, my wife, Nora, I could even imagine with the pandemic going on and the kids trying to learn from home and on laptops, what an extreme challenge. And I think we, you know, we as a country and as a world underestimated really what, you know, kind of, especially in the developed countries, you know, kind of what a gift it is to be able to have our kids, to be able to go to an institution and go and learn face to face, with these educators that are experts in their field. You know, the parents unable to, you know, teach the kids, I don't know, the new math and, you know, things like that. I mean, there's no way I could do that. I graduated at the bottom of my high school class. So there's no way possible I could have taught my kids anything. Matter of fact, I mean, it's probably the other way around. They're the ones that people teach me, but, you know, starting off every day on that right foot and making, you know, like I said, starting with gratitude for what you have, you know, the food in your belly, the clothes on your back, and, you know, for us as Americans living in a country that is still far and above one of the best places on earth to be living in, pandemic or no pandemic, you know, Republicans or Democrats, does not matter. We are still living in one of the best countries that you could ever hope for. So right there, that's your big number one to be grateful for every day.
If I can ask, real quick, I know we're kind of winding down on time. What is kind of the method that you use personally for documenting, expressing, or feeling that gratitude?
Actually, it starts with, I mean, even before I put my feet on the floor, getting out of bed, I wake up and, you know, I've made it a habit to just immediately think about what am I doing today? And then I also just, you know, I look around at my surroundings, just even in my bedroom. I don't live in a big fancy house. I've got a nice house. It's a humble home, but nonetheless, I mean, I've got a roof over my head. I've got walls to protect me from, you know, the weather. And, you know, and I've got, you know, my wife laying there next to me, and that's just one of those things. And it doesn't matter what time of day I need to wake up, you know, 4 a.m., 5 a.m., 6 a.m. It doesn't matter. I'm still grateful that, you know, I had a place to sleep. I had a bed to, you know, to lay in and, you know, warm sheets to be under. And, you know, that's kind of where I start.
Excellent. Well, Steve, it has been an immense pleasure to have you here on the show and talk about these things. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I'd like my audience to reach out to you. So how can people reach out to you, support you, and see what you're doing?
My website, frogmanleadership.com. And I'm also on Twitter. Excellent. And LinkedIn.
I will get that in the show notes. But we also need to give our audience some action items. So this is the list that I came up with. Number one, work on resilience in all its aspects. Number two, don't overthink. Number three, ask, what could I have done better today? Number four, start each day with a little bit of gratitude. Is there anything that you'd like to add to that list?
Be a better version of yourself every day.
I love it. Be a better version of yourself every day. All right. Well, again, thank you so much, Steve, for coming on the show. Audience, definitely reach out to him. And yeah, thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Justin.
Thank you so much, guys, for listening to another episode of the Hard Thing Podcast. I'm extremely grateful for you listeners out there who come back every week, listening to the show, and I'm grateful for the support you give. I talked a little bit more about the struggles I'm going through right now, and it's kicking my butt. I'll be honest, it's pretty hard, pretty tough. So hopefully you get something great out of today's episode, and you are built up, you're strengthened against the time when you will face a difficult challenge that will stretch you and test you. Because if you're not prepared, it's even less fun. Thank you guys for listening to today's show. Before we close out, one quick announcement. I'd like to invite you guys to go to OURrescue.org and get involved. OUR is a nonprofit organization that goes undercover to rescue kids from sex trafficking. They do tremendous work. They're amazing people, and they need lots of help. And the biggest help you can give is just by informing yourself. So go to OURrescue.org, learn as much as you can, and that will change lives. You don't think it might, but let me tell you, when you can spot the signs of human trafficking and know what to do about them, you are so much more prepared for when you probably see that in your life that one time and you do the right thing. So again, go to OURrescue.org, get prepared, know what to do, and help out. Second of all, I'd like to invite you to go to Instagram at The Hard Thing Podcast. Give us a follow and send me a DM with any personal questions or questions about the show or suggestions. I'd love to continue the conversation there and get involved. If you guys are interested in merchandise, go to theheartthingpodcast.com. You can find our store there, which has all sorts of cool knickknacks and goodies like shirts, t-shirts. I said shirts twice. I do that all the time. But shirts, hoodies, hats, things like that. Lastly, come back next week for another amazing episode with another great guest. We'll see you then. Make sure you guys keep doing hard things, though, because you will overcome average. Hey guys, one quick announcement for today's show, and you might have heard this already, even in today's episode, but I have an awesome opportunity for you guys. Once in a lifetime, you have the opportunity to have dinner with myself and a covert CIA operative. That's right, an undercover spy. My guest, Andrew Bustamante, has been gracious enough to offer himself up as guest for a dinner with myself and one lucky audience member. So if you want to sign up for that, make sure you hit the link in the show notes below. As well, you can go to Instagram and hit the link in my bio at The Hard Thing Podcast. This is first come, first serve, and there's only one slot. So whoever signs up first will have the opportunity to come to Utah and have dinner with myself and Andrew Bustamante. It's an exciting opportunity. It's one that you'll be able to brag about to your friends of being able to sit down having dinner with an undercover secret agent. So don't waste any time. Go ahead and sign up in the link in the show notes or go to Instagram at The Hard Thing Podcast and click the link in my bio and you'll find all the relevant information there. So look forward to having dinner with you.